Welcome to the Deeper Podcast, everyone. I'm your host, Austin Slater, and joining me today, I've got the dynamic duo. I've got Dan Kinnis and Tim Howlerda. Dan and Tim, so good to have you guys back.
Thank you, Austin. Good to be back.
Thanks, Austin. Good to be here.
Tim, so we just kind of started up a new series on missions for our mission emphasis time. And you gave the inaugural sermon. It was, you know, in my opinion, an incredible opening pitch. But could you just give us a brief summary of what you kind of talked about and what some of the highlights were?
Yeah, we just looked at the Good Samaritan parable of Jesus and the religious lawyer who had approached Jesus with that question, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus, of course, tells this wonderful story that's so rich and full of meaning, turning it upside down and asking the question in return, which one was the neighbor of the three that found the man on the road beaten by robbers and bleeding? So yeah, I just kind of laid out a very simple but very challenging call to service and care to all of us.
And there's so much in that story that I think is just such a profound story. The one thing that I noticed right away, right off the bat this time, was just the question that, you know, he asked. He asked, who is my neighbor? And I know, like, us with hindsight, it's kind of a telling question, you know, but because it sounds to me almost like he's asking for a blessing of exclusion. And, you know, he's asking for permission to say, hey, who do I have to care about and who don't I have to care about? I just thought that's an incredibly telling question from a religious lawyer of the time.
Yeah, it is. It seems like it's an evasive question. He's trying to justify not helping certain people. And it'd be nice if that exclusion was large, then it would be simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just something I never really noticed, and so I thought that was interesting. And I kind of wonder sometimes how often we look for that blessing of exclusion. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I did want to ask a question about the whole about the Samaritan specifically, and Dan, you can feel free to weigh in on this as well. But we hear all the time as we study scripture, you know, the Jews and the Samaritans didn't get along, and we're kind of distant from that. We don't really understand the depths of some of this. Mm-hmm. And so how shocking it would be that the Samaritan was the good neighbor. And so I was just trying to think, you know, what might some modern example, what would something be now that we could hear, this is the good neighbor, and we would feel the same amount of shock? Just always trying to personalize it, modernize it so we can understand it. I was wondering, given our context here at Friendship, would it be a reach to say we would experience the same shock if the story were told today and the Samaritan were transgender? Would that be an appropriate response so that we can understand the shock that the Jews would have heard in this time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. There's we don't understand always the cultural, historical realities of Jews and Samaritans, but we certainly understand people groups that we just don't agree with and find an immediate sort of visceral reaction against. So your suggestion is a good one. Like, I think that's true. The sort of visceral disgust that we have with certain groups, whatever that may be, and we don't want to single anyone out, but certainly between the heterosexual and the LGBTQ community, there is some of that feeling today, both directions. Mm-hmm. And racially, there's plenty of different racial groups that individuals within may feel that to a greater degree or less. So I think that's a helpful way of sort of helping us live into it. It's like, yeah, that's something we can relate to, and that's probably getting close to what the Jews and Samaritans would feel towards each other.
Okay. Yeah, you think of the religious aspect too. I wonder, having taught this story before as well, sometimes I think of from an American context, American Christian context, that thinking of someone, a Muslim, perhaps, right, in the story, and taking that place of the Samaritan might be shocking for us, especially maybe even as we were closer to events of 9/11 and that, right, as someone who we saw as an enemy who just, even on that religious level, is just, they're in a different place than we are. And Samaritans and Jews had some crossover, just like Christians and Islam does as well, but there's obviously big differences that are often highlighted, and I think that sometimes would make us think too, like, oh, okay. And I always wonder why, you know, Jesus, of course, is telling a story. You know, he's picking how he wants the characters to go and to do, and so you wonder, boy, yeah, he is trying to make a point here, and he could have used, you know, just an Israelite for that example. He could have used, the priest even or something like that, and still made the point like, well, this is the person being a neighbor, but he goes this very memorable and shocking route.
And the way that none of the people would have expected him to go.
I would think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it always makes me think about it more, too. Not just who might be mm-hmm. an example, but I probably need to think more about what Jesus is saying here.
Right.
He's making it a very memorable point. So.
Yeah, I always find that so convicting to just think about, like, man, he really, when he called out the people that they disagreed with the most, and he's like, they can be the good neighbor. They can be better than I. How can we improve? So I just thought that was interesting. So thank you guys both for your insights on that. That's very helpful. Tim, you said at one point that niceness doesn't heal wounds, but love heals wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was so powerful because it's so true. You know, being nice, it's great. It's important. It's good. It's not going to fix any of the big long-term issues. So I was wondering, what do we do when a situation comes up and our definitions of love look different? So like the way I love my brother when something hard comes up in his life might be different from the way either of you guys love your siblings when something goes crazy. What do we do when our definitions of love and what we need look different? Because love isn't just being kind. There's that.
Mm-hmm. You
know, that's a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we handle that complexity of what love looks like? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I can just start out. I think part of it is maybe part of the love is discovering what maybe that looks like in the situation you're in or toward the person you're trying to care for. Because you're right, it does look different for different people. We talk about love languages, right? And even think of that with spouses or family members. So maybe even just taking the time to figure that out is a way of loving someone, you know, really going to that length. Because it's easy. On the surface, I can be nice to you, both you guys, and to a lot of people in the exact same way. And that would all be characterized as, oh, he's a nice guy.
Mm.
But maybe that going deeper, what does that look like for Austin compared to Tim, to Dan, and to dive in deeper and maybe not to just assume I know exactly what that looks like for.
And to assume it'd be received the same way.
Right, right. Exactly. Well, this worked for so-and-so. Why is this working for you? And you maybe have a whole different history, maybe even been hurt in a way by a certain type of expression or something, too. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, Tim, if you got any
thoughts. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it deepens the challenge of love because it's more than what we think is a nice gesture. It's what does that person receive to be the needed gesture or ministry. And I can offer one of my kids a nice cup of coffee, but three of them don't drink coffee. They don't. They don't find that at all helpful. They're looking for something different. And I think that's a good question. And I think just to keep us aware that whenever we're trying to help somebody, we have to also be very sensitive to what that help looks like and how that's perceived.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Another question I kind of had, because you were chock full of home runs. It was incredible. I loved it. One of those home run hits that you had is, you know, what the wounded need sometimes is presence, not a check.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, that hit home for me. I know so many people, especially in our Western context, think that, you know, some access to money or resources is going to fix our problem. And, you know, sometimes those can help stem some of the bleeding, but that's not going to fix the problem. And especially in a missions context, you and I both, and Dan, I'm sure you've seen as well, like, we know the problem when someone comes in and just writes a blank check to try and fix problems. And I just, you know, I just wanted to comment on how much I appreciated that and, you know, maybe give you a chance to riff off of that a little bit, just what, how important that is.
Yeah, I think maybe it's our uniquely American challenges, but we're so aware of needs and we want to fix it. And so we think of how can we most efficiently fix the problem. And that often is like, well, let's throw resources at it. But honestly, the best solution sometimes is a very small increments of help that are very intensive, that require a lot of people hours. And that's not what we want. We want to fix the whole community. We don't want to go and have coffee and develop a relationship with one person in that
community. And learn how to love that one person.
Right. But that's really what it requires, right?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, you said it in the sermon, didn't you? I think that how our kids spell love is T-I-M-E, right? Our time, which is our presence, really. And That is a good way to think of it. Just how do we, you know, put resources towards something and someone, which is often helpful, but where do we put ourselves in? Mm-hmm. I was thinking of that as you asked, Austin, about when it comes to God, of course, that's what we want and need. We don't want his resources, although we'll gladly mm-hmm. receive them. We want him and his presence. Mm-hmm. And I was drawn to that Old Testament story in Exodus when the people have left Egypt and are going out. And God says, I'll send you with my resources. My angel will go with you. And Moses says, no way. If you don't go, we're not going because it's not going to be worth it. And I'm thinking for us too, that's what really people need. Mm-hmm. And maybe sometimes we're surprised that they would want us and our presence, and that would be enough. But I probably, if we just look at our own lives and saw how the presence of a parent or a friend or has impacted us, it wasn't. Yeah, I mean, I know they showed their love, they helped me out monetarily, or they, you know, but really it's, they've been there for me.
Well, and you hear so many stories from people from an upper class background who, you know, they grow up and they've got all the resources of their family at their disposal and no real relationship, and how much that just devastates them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody said to me early in my ministry, never underestimate the power of human empathy. And that's the presence of a person who really listens and cares. And that in itself is healing, right? We talk about a wounded person. That's healing already. And you can't pay for that.
Yeah.
That just takes presence.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, Tim, is there anything else you'd like to highlight from the sermon on Sunday or add that you may not have necessarily brought up?
I think there's just, I threw that little thing in there from Charles Spurgeon I thought was really helpful to me, that there's a point where some people deserve to suffer, sometimes you can have such a bleeding heart that we just want to help everybody, and that's not always helpful, right? There's sometimes you really, and you always have to be discerning. We get people coming through the doors here all the time looking for help from the church, and sometimes it's appropriate to give, and sometimes it's appropriate to say, you know, no, we're not going to, or you need to go do this. And it's hard to do that when you don't know the person in the situation, but I think that's just, to me, that was just a really helpful thing to ponder about. Even the Lord expects that there's human responsibility, and where a person can help themselves, then they should.
Yeah.
And if they're hurting because they've thrown away those opportunities through their own laziness or self-indulgence, then the loving thing to do is not to bail them out. The loving thing to do is say, yeah, come alongside. It really hurts when reality consequences bite.
Thank you. Dan, I want to also put you on the spot a little bit because you also preached on Sunday.
Yes, yeah.
For those of you who don't necessarily know, we do have two sermons every Sunday, one in the morning, one in the evening, totally different. And Dan has been talking a lot about leadership and leadership through Titus and what good leadership can look like. And one thing, I just kind of, you already kind of talked about it a little bit in that service, but I wanted to just get a little more clarification. There was a lot of specific instructions that were given to different demographic groups in this most recent one. You know, there was stuff for older men, older women, young men, young women, slaves. And all of these specific instructions for these specific groups emphasize traits that really all of us should be developing no matter which group we fit into. You know, old men should be just as self-controlled as young men, or hardworking as young women, or sober as old women, or any number of combinations that you can see there. I was just kind of wondering, could you explain again why those were specifically directed at those specific groups potentially?
So one of the things we always have to bear in mind as we come, especially to those letters in the New Testament, and this is the way I was taught it as well, and I think it's just a good reminder that really, we're only getting half of a conversation at best, right? We're hearing typically what the Apostle Paul or another writer is writing into a situation or to a person, and we're not hearing back the response or maybe what precipitated some of the content of those letters. And so bearing in mind that, you know, we're humbly entering into that and wondering because we only have so much of the context, but you often wonder with Titus in writing to the churches there on Crete, if some of those specifics being addressed had to do with some of the characteristics that were being exemplified or not exemplified there amongst that community and in that culture, and maybe some specifically in these groups for men and women of a certain age, or even amidst slaves he addresses there, that maybe he's saying you need to live a little differently than what is typical on the island, and maybe even some of the highlighting, because in other places, like Paul specifically with the women in Titus there in chapter 2, addresses their relationship to their husband. But he says nothing to the guys about their relationship to their wives in that case. But elsewhere, he has no qualms about talking to both in Ephesians, right? Men, you do this, treat your wives this way. Women, wives, you treat your husbands this way. But why not in Titus? And it makes me wonder if there was maybe some specifics of that situation, that maybe there were some issues in regards to those relationships that were coming out culturally. But again, without having that more documentation or a letter they wrote back or Titus's report back, I mean, I would be very interested in seeing some of that. But that would be some of my best guess as well. And we said, too, that in Titus 2, the emphasis is always falling on, as far as the reasoning, think about the way this represents the gospel and represents, of course, God himself and who he is. And we don't want the word of God to be maligned. We don't want others to have a lot of reasons to point out things we're doing poorly or mistreating others. Or then, of course, we want the gospel to be attractive. And so some of that, again, points me to there's some connection here to what is going on in that specific context as well, that we would want the believers to bear in mind in the way they're living.
Right. And so it's not necessarily being explicitly, this is what these groups should be, but it's context dependent. It's prescriptive for that scenario, not necessarily prescriptive for all scenarios, that these are the exclusive things we need to focus on.
And that's the hard part, right? Because there's things in there like, you know, be kind. Well, I mean, we would say, of course, any Christian in pretty much any context should be that. And then others, you say, boy, that seems more specific. And that's always the hard, that's where some of the disagreements come in, even among Christians, too. What seems more culturally kind of driven and what seems more universal? And even, like you said at the start here, some of these, you know, well, that's not just for an older man. I mean, that would be good if I'm a younger woman to live that way, to live temperately, to live self-controlled in that way, to have a respectable life. And so there's even wondering, reading that chapter, if Paul himself, you know, spent some time planning that church but maybe didn't know the people that well. So he stays fairly general, maybe. Again, a lot of speculation, no doubt, but yeah, and I could see where there's some of that. You'd say, wow, this is absolutely something any Christian at any time in any context should be living that way, and others where maybe we wrestle with more, even the address to slaves, you know. We would look at that and hear that quite a bit differently in our context from what the people there probably would have heard, so.
Yeah, well, thank you. And that's, again, really helpful to just remember that, like, with almost all of these, especially New Testament letters, we're only getting the one letter and not the context necessarily behind it or the responses or, yeah, that knowledge. And so, again, thanks for helping give that framework and reminder.
I thought you brought that out in the sermon right at the beginning, too, setting that context, in the pointing out in that chapter how many times it talks about making it attractive. Like, these are a minority in a new place. It's a new concept of following Jesus. And so that just, I think that context setting helps understand what Paul is writing. So I thought that was helpful.
And I think, and that's a conversation for another day perhaps, but I think it's fascinating the fact that we're told to make the gospel attractive to other people. And man, that opens up a whole new can of worms as far as like behaviors and whether these are salvific or non-salvific. And just, again, maybe for a different time, but like.
Well, I think it is a really good conversation for a different time, though, because, you know, it's what's our sensitivities to the cultural perceptions of us, right?
Yeah.
And we may be right about something, but if we're tone deaf in terms of how people perceive it and we're putting Christ in a bad light, we're not achieving what we want, which is to make Christ glorious. And so
maybe needing to not necessarily compromise our being right, but compromise our being right loudly.
Yeah.
You guys have both been in mission contexts, you know, different cultures, and so you probably have experiences, too, as you're trying to share with people. But, yeah, how do you make that attractive, right? And even how do you connect? I look at the Apostle Paul, and in his different contexts, he did do different presentations. I mean, Athens is the best example I can think of in Acts 17, where Paul talks about this in a different way. He doesn't start off with some of the things he would talking to maybe a more of a Jewish background of people in the synagogue. He talks about some of their poets, and oh, I saw these idols in your town, and he's making those connections, and you know, it has some fruit, and other parts, you know, maybe people thought he was a little crazy, but
well,
it's something to think about.
Being sensitive to the culture you're in is so critical. I mean, I remember, I grew up, for those of you who don't know, I grew up in rural East Africa in Uganda and Kenya, and one of the big things was, you know, how you dressed, what you wore. And one of the fascinating things was, you know, in especially the more rural parts, women could be completely topless. And that was fine. Nobody cared. But if they showed their knees, that was the issue because that was part of that culture. And so, you know, obviously we weren't necessarily walking around completely topless all the time. But, like, again, just being sensitive to, hey, what is the culture we're in? We have the freedoms to do all these things, but how can we use them in a way that doesn't make people stumble and distract from the message of Christ.
Yeah, it's great.
Putting it together too, thinking of what Tim was talking about yesterday morning as well, and just that, I think the question you asked almost at the outset about loving different people in maybe different contexts, and I think that's part of it too, trying to understand, because it's so easy for me to say, well, this is what I like, this is what has worked for me, and this is what I think is the right way of doing the Christian faith, say, or the Christian life. And then realizing, oh, there might be some things that can be expressed quite differently within that context, and others that we got to hold, you know, strongly too. And so that's, I think, even within the church, loving each other well takes that effort, those conversations, as much as we can have them, even cross culturally, just that empathy. I think Tim used that word, that energy going toward what does this look like, and what do I maybe need to hold a little less tightly so that I can love this person well, because this thing is just, it's something I really enjoy and appreciate, but it's not this fundamental of the faith, right? We're not sacrificing what we believe, who we are. It's more of a window dressing thing, the style of music I like, or dress, as you said.
Well, that's a lovely conversation, guys. Thank you so much both for your insight and your wisdom and your willingness to delve into this. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining us, for wrestling with us. We look forward to talking again next week, learning more, growing deeper. Go in peace, everyone. Thanks.
Yep. Bye. Thanks, Austin.